Osiris.
Hi, my name is Tim Wheaton. I'm the host of the Daddy Unscripted podcast. No, it's not just me talking with dads about being dads, and it's not just for dads, that's for sure. What it is a varied spectrum of inspiring stories and emotional tales from a wide range of guests that come from the world of sports, of music, and even the guy that lives down the street from you. Not that guy, but the other guy. Yeah, that one. I can pretty much guarantee you're going to get something out of every episode. So come check out the Daddy Unscripted podcast.
I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer.
And this is The Road to Now. Ben, how's that pizza?
Dude, it's so good. My dad just brought it back. I'm not going to tell you what company it's from, but it's good. It's up the street from my house.
Oh, man, I like pizza. I love pizza. Don't eat it very often, but, man, do I love it.
Let me tell you what kind of father I have. I have the kind of a father who will, while I am reading an article and making notes on it, come to my house, mow the grass for me, and then go get some pizza and bring it back. What a dad.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and we could go into a lot of detail about the depth of his kindness and his character. There's a lot that I know about him that... I tell you, I would love to have him in my life as well. He's a great fella.
I agree. Thanks, Bob. Well, speaking of fathers and giving birth to things or people, Bob, this week our topic is your project. We're going to talk about Apex, North Carolina.
Yes, the metropolitan behemoth that is Apex, North Carolina. Population, roughly 58,000. But... that's population today. In 1962, the population of Apex was about 1,700.
Yes, and that's interesting, Bob. But I think the more interesting thing is if you look at it from 1990 to today.
Yes, in 1990, the population was 5,000, and it reached 34,000 by 2008. Today, close to 58,000.
Yes, that is huge growth.
Gee, I wonder what could spark such an incredible burst in population in such a relatively short period of time.
I would read that book.
You would?
Yes. I believe that. Maybe I have read a proposal for that book in the last day or so.
Maybe this is a proposal. This is essentially my research paper for my urban history class, which just closed officially today. And let me tell you a story about this class. You know, as listeners to this show very well know, that my focus in school this past year and a half, however long I've been in school, has been the Irish Catholics in the antebellum period. That has been the area that every class that I take, you know, you have to write a paper for every class. I always try to look at it from the view of what the Catholics at that time were doing, or the Irish or the immigrants. So this class was very much outside of my comfort zone. And I got to tell you, I didn't know what to expect from urban history. And in fact, the day the class opened, I was so overwhelmed with my family duties, with work, with our podcast, with all the things that I have just going on in my life, that I was going to drop the class. You know, I was going to say, let me just take this semester off. I'll pick something up next semester. I don't think I can do this right now. This seems overwhelming, especially when I read the syllabus and I saw that I was going to have to write a research paper and using primary sources. Okay. So, but you know, I like the professor seemed great to me. And so the first thing he says, first day of class, is find a topic for your research paper, which is completely ridiculous when you don't know anything about urban history. How can you find a topic for a research paper due in like 5 days? So I start looking at the cities around me because, you know, if I need primary sources, I should be looking around me. So I looked at Raleigh and Durham. And when I looked into Durham, and Durham had so many fascinating historical narratives that I could have tracked down. And, you know, when you talk about urban history, you're talking about the history of space in a lot of ways, and the human populations that have moved through that space over time. So you're talking about the history of downtown. You're talking about the history of a particular building, of a particular city, of a particular group of people, and how life has changed for them. And this class was focused on 20th century urban history. So I'm looking into Durham. I probably find five kind of leads on topics that would just be amazingly fascinating. But while I'm looking into Durham, I find the Research Triangle Park. And for those of you that aren't aware, the Research Triangle Park, it's called the Triangle Park because it's essentially a geographic triangle between NC State, Duke University, and UNC Chapel Hill. And it's this suburban, low-density research park that was established in the late 1950s. Now, what's interesting about this place is, let's think about North Carolina in the 1950s. What do you think about, Ben? Ben, you're from North Carolina. If I said North Carolina, 1950s, what do you think?
I think resistance to integration. I think Greensboro.
Okay, you know, the Greensboro Four?
Yeah, I mean, that's 1960, right?
Yeah, 60, but the 50s. What do you think about, what about the economy of North Carolina in the 1950s?
Huge transition. Going from that, you know, what Jeff Cowie points out is the, you know, the South becoming the American capital's first third world. The deindustrialization of the North beginning and the flow of capital into the South with major production, building on the textile production from the interwar era. And yeah, just a lot of transition, a lot of people moving to the South.
So basically what Ben's saying in English is textiles, furniture, tobacco. That's what Ben's saying, right?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and for all of you, if you hear in the background, that's Joe Kwan yelling at Wimbledon, probably. So textiles, tobacco, furniture. And these are economies that are dying. The per capita economy of North Carolina in the mid-1950s was about $1,000. Okay?
Right.
So there was a guy named Romeo Guest. Okay? Romeo Guest, he was basically what he did was he was an entrepreneur, and he assisted northern textile companies when they moved to the South. And he realized that his business was not as thriving as it was just a few years before. And he looked into the future, and he didn't see much business for himself.
Wow.
So what he decided to do was he went to NC State and met with members of the textile research department there. And he had this idea to develop a scientific research park that fed off of the universities in North Carolina. And that ultimately becomes RTP.
Right. So what he says is, I see that the future of this industry may be declining, but I'm surrounded by institutions filled with people who are thinking about these questions. Let's take their academic skill set and try to apply it practically in a concentrated way that pulls all these resources together.
Right. So he gets some buy-in, right? Guys, Malcolm Campbell was the dean of the School of Textiles. William Newell was the director of Textile Research Center. They write basically a position paper, and he takes it to Luther Hodges, who at the time is the governor of North Carolina. Hodges likes the idea, but does not want to use state funds to fund a private project, which at the time, Romeo Guest was proposing a private project.
Right.
So they were seeking investors. Luther Hodges connects Mr. Guest with Carl Robbins, who was a retired textile mill owner. Robbins makes an initial investment of $1 million. They formed Pinelands Incorporated and begin selling stock.
Okay.
The stock's not selling. Soon, a guy named Archie Davis comes on board. Archie Davis was the new head of Wachovia Bank at the time. Archie Davis looks at the proposal for the project. He says, something about this isn't right. This private model, this is like all wrong, right? This project needs to be for the public good, because if we are able to set up a research center in North Carolina, it will forever rebrand the state of North Carolina, and it will give us an economy that can compete with the rest of the country through the rest of the 20th century and into the 21st century. So Davis says, I'll come on board, but I think this needs to be nonprofit.
And he gets his way.
He gets his way. They establish the Research Triangle Foundation, and Davis goes around asking for donations, not investments. What you have soon, the first company to come in 1959 is Chemstrand. Our listeners may be aware by their current name, Monsanto.
Oh, boy.
And then in the early to mid-60s, IBM comes on board, and that changes everything. And the Department of Environmental Sciences comes about the same time that IBM comes. And that forever changes the economic destiny of the state of North Carolina.
Okay. So, can I interject here?
Oh, please, because I feel like I'm just rambling.
No. This is all good stuff. So here's the thing. You have your question, I think, right?
Yeah, I can tell you my question.
Tell me your question.
Well, basically, the point of the research paper is to explore how high-tech economic infrastructure couples with historical nostalgia to structure the urban growth of small cities in the Research Triangle and North Carolina more broadly. But to even boil that down so we can all understand it, I'm looking at how this high-tech research park impacted Apex, North Carolina, which at the time of its inception was a sleepy ex-railroad town with a couple of small industries and low population. And over time, because of RTP, Apex and the cities around it, the small cities like Cary and Mooresville, we're seeing it with Fuquay Varina, Hillsborough's impacted, how all these little southern kind of like towns with these historical downtown main streets, how they have all kind of benefited and boomed, taking the whole area from Raleigh to Durham to Chapel Hill. It is now one large metropolitan region as opposed to multiple smaller metropolitan areas.
Okay, so what's your question?
My question is, how did that happen?
Here are the things that I think are fascinating about this. First of all, this happening in the context of the Cold War, right? So this stuff goes down at a time where government and technology and like research, like the relationship is like consolidating in a way. I mean, this is the birth of the era of the military industrial complex, right? And in this partnership. So when you look at this, how does the story of Apex fit into that greater story of the Cold War?
You know what's interesting about RTP as opposed to, everybody knows Palo Alto, California and Stanford,
right,
which was kind of the template for doing something like this. But RTP is not related to that, and it did not receive the federal funds and the federal assistance, at least in its initial inception, that Stanford did receive. And I think what's really interesting, one of the sources, secondary sources I used for this was Margaret Pugh O'Mara.
Yeah.
And she's got a book called Cities of Knowledge, Cold War Science, and the Search for the Next Silicon Valley. And she points out that with the Cold War, the government realized that it needed to do a lot of research and prioritize military scientific research, right? But the American political tradition, we're not really, and particularly in the mid-20th century, we're not all about a strong federal government, right? You do have the New Deal, and this is, you know, my professor said, you know, I don't think this is part of the New Deal, because that was kind of one of my early arguments. I was like, well, this is kind of an outgrowth of the New Deal. But Omar says that the solution to the idea of having a strong private sector and a weak federal government was to empower the universities and private scientific industries to become agents and partners with the government. So instead of saying taking over the scientific industry and taking over the university, the federal government decided to become partners, which gave a lot of power to localities and local economies because of that.
Hey friends, you're listening to The Road to Now. which means that you like to listen and learn. Well, what if I told you there was a way that you could, when this episode wraps up, that you could just go to another place and not just get a podcast, but get books that would do it the same way? Ladies and gentlemen, one of our sponsors, Libro.fm, is an audiobook company that lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for booksellers around the country, and we've even got a Road to Now playlist there, so you can find books by our previous guests, including Jefferson Cowie, Edward Baptist, so many great authors. I listen to books all the time on Libro, and I just love it. One of the things that I do is I love listening to novels, right, to fiction. I don't spend a lot of time reading fiction, but when you get a book written by one of the great authors, a lot of times they read them themselves and have other voices. So I listen to B.J. Novick's One More Thing, which is one of my favorite pieces of fiction and short stories that I've read in forever. And I loved it so much, I got it so I could listen to B.J. Novick read it. And it was like a whole new experience. So you can go to Libro.fm and you can use our promo code RTN. And with that, you'll get 3 months of audiobook membership for the price of 1 month, which means that for just $15, you'll get 3 months, one book a piece, and you'll get yourself a big book if you want to. You know, you can get a whole month out of something like a Grant biography or Washington biographies. So as if you love what we're doing and you love your local bookstore, please support us and go to Libro.fm. That's Libro.fm. Enter the promo code RTN. And join us there. We hope that you'll support them. As I said, I was a member of Libro before. We picked them up as a sponsor. I actually approached them myself and said, will you sponsor us? Because I love their model. So go check them out. You can go to Libro.fm or you can go to our episode page. There's links on every one of those. Check them out. Thank you guys for supporting us and enjoy this episode. You say that Palo Alto got more federal funding. That in a lot of ways makes sense just because you've got, you know, a lot of things going on there between Stanford and then, you know, the relationship with UCLA down further south. But, you know, you've got a lot of infrastructure there. You got Berkeley right not far from there. So here's the question. Like, if North Carolina isn't getting the federal funding for the Research Triangle Park, it's state funding and local funding, right?
Right.
This is interesting
and
because
it's donations, right?
Right. So here's the thing, federal funding, and they know this, even if it's not the New Deal, Southern politicians know this. Federal funding comes with strings attached. So like the New Deal worker programs, like they fought that tooth and nail, but eventually they had to deal with the fact that like when you got money from the federal government to do things, you couldn't segregate on the basis of race. How much does that affect the federal funding there? Are they aware of this or like how does that play out?
You know, that is a question that I will explore because I'm going to make this paper my capstone project, which means that next spring I will broaden this out from a 20-page paper to a 30-page paper, essentially. And I'm going to look more into – I didn't look into the social impacts at all in this paper. But I did another secondary source I used, which was Technology in the Garden by Michael Luger and Harvey Goldstein. These guys kind of allude to this. They say part of the success of RTP was due to, and I want to find the exact quote, a line of governors who by Southern standards were politically moderate and activist and a group of civic-minded business leaders. So guys like Archie Davis, these were private businessmen who felt a duty to the state to do something for the state. Right? They wanted to do something for the state. It was about helping other people. And also, the governor who follows Luther Hodges is Terry Sanford. Terry Sanford's the first Southern Democratic governor to support John F. Kennedy in his bid for the presidency. And many, a lot of the reading I did, that's kind of why the Department of Environmental Sciences landed at RTP because who do you think the Commerce Secretary was in the Kennedy administration? Who
was
Luther
that?
Hodges.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, politics is involved here in a big way. But that's something I want to expand on when I revisit this project.
Yeah, this is the thing about it. Like I read this And Bob, like, I'm going to send you my notes that I took on it. I'm going to show you right now if you can see, like, every single page on this thing has notes on it. And, like, most of them are like, oh my God, you got to check out this book. Or, like, what are the parallels here? And I think it's, like, one of my favorite parts about this is, like, you bring into what is urban history, right? Which I think is a fascinating thing because, like, urban history brings together, because it's space, right? So it's, like, everything. It's the history of the natural earth combined with human and other biological changes. And, like, it's all interacting. But you do this cool thing where you break down the way they recruited people to come there with a pamphlet.
Oh, I love this. This was my, you know, you would think I've been working on this for a year. I've been working on it for 6 weeks. Like, so there's so many threads that Ben, and I'm glad you took these notes because I'm going to need them because I will take time away from this topic and then I will come back at it with new eyes. And yeah. I feel like what I did in this paper was just kind of highlighted a bunch of threads, right? But I still need to weave them together into something more coherent. But let me just shout out to Apex North Carolina Town Management, because the town manager, Drew Havens, he allowed me to interview him. And Will Brown, who works in planning, sent me all kinds of Chamber of Commerce maps and the a PowerPoint presentation that they have that shows the corporate growth of Apex from the time that the town was established in 1872 into present day. And he sent, one of the things that Will sent me was this Chamber of Commerce brochure from 1962. And on the cover is this bathing beauty, this woman in a bathing suit. Now Apex at the time was the home to the Roxanne Bathing Suit Company, I believe. If you think about textiles, that kind of makes sense. But the cover of this Chamber of Commerce brochure declares, and this is 1964, big letters, work, live profitably, graciously. So you got to think, at this point, RTP is about, you know, 5 years old at this point, okay? And there's all these, like, drawings on it, like a cow, which you think, okay, this symbolizes the agricultural tradition of the area. A drawing of a train. Apex started out as a train stop in the 1870s. It was Apex. It was the highest point in the area. Duh. Makes sense. Apex, right? And it seems to, the whole pamphlet seems to beckon for young men of science to come settle in Apex and be part of the city of tomorrow is basically right. The whole point. Now, my professor pointed out to me, city of tomorrow. That word was used in a pamphlet. You don't use that phrase just willy-nilly. City right. of tomorrow had meaning to it.
Yeah, it did.
It did. In the 1939 World's Fair in New York, there was an exhibition, and it was the City of Tomorrow. City of Tomorrow also borrowed by Disney World with that, or Disneyland, just opened Tomorrowland. So this isn't just using a phrase. There's a meaning to this. To City of Tomorrow.
It's a very 1950s thing, right?
It really is. And so the pamphlet proclaims, capital letters, with its friendly, progressive people, excellent educational and transportation facilities, ideal climate, and land for residential and industrial growth, invites your inquiry and inspection. With the bathing beauty and the woman in the bathing suit on the cover, it's almost like, oh, young men of science, come to Apex. Come here and settle. We have a brand new hospital. We've got new schools. We are, the best part, we're 20 miles from the Research Triangle Park. It's just an easy drive down Highway 164 or NC-55. We've got two railroads, and we have the brand new Seaboard Airline.
Oh, the Seaboard Airline. My favorite story about that is John Galbraith is a great crash. He talks about how during the 1920s, people had the idea that airline companies were going to go under. And so people dumped their Seaboard Airline stocks. But Seaboard Airline was a railroad, not an actual airline. Anyway, that's just a non sequitur. Okay, so I'm laying this out. Here's what I love about this, because in the middle of like an urban history project, you kind of pull out and you do something that works, but you turn towards more of like a cultural analysis, because you're breaking down like what all this could mean. And it's like fabulous where you're like, hey, you know, there was a bathing suit manufacturer there. Maybe that's what it meant. But come on, like it's a woman in a bikini. Like we know if that was what it was, it's like they were looking for a reason to do that anyway. Right. So it's like selling youth. Right?
Yes.
It's selling youth. It's new, right? It's just promise.
Ben Moore, it's selling suburbia. So what is happening in the 1940s and 50s? People are leaving. Well, some people who could are leaving the cities. And now there's a whole history behind that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the government did give money to people who were building outside of the city, outside of what would become the Beltline someday. But outside of the cities, you have this incentive to build these suburban communities. So the idea of these research centers, it's the idea of you work in the suburban environment in which you live. You live, no longer is it you live in an apartment in downtown and you walk down Main Street, a left on Johnson Street, a right on Smith Avenue, and then you go to your accounting firm or whatever. No, now you live 20 miles outside the city. You have a car. We all have cars now. And you drive to, you're a young scientist. You drive to your research Triangle Park with, the streets are lined with pine trees. You know, and there are like manicured lawns and sidewalks, and it's a new suburban lifestyle.
Yeah, and your taxes are lower because you're outside the city,
and then you drive to the shopping mall, right?
Yep.
Where the parking lots are really big and open, so women were able to navigate the parking lots.
Uh-huh.
So there's gender issues here.
Wow, I didn't even know that. That's fascinating.
Oh, we need to get Liz Cohen on.
Oh, dude, Consumers Republic? Yeah.
Yes, that is the book.
Oh, my God.
That is the greatest book ever written this week that I've ever read. but, you know, the idea that a shopping mall with its fountain in the center, it was the idea of reconstructing Main Street and reconstructing the downtown clock tower. Yes, I've got the book under my bunk right here.
I'm holding the book up now because it is literally sitting within arm's reach of where I sit at my desk.
That book should be in arm's reach of everyone. At any minute, you may need to pick that book up and read it.
That's great.
It is really great. But the idea that, you know, downtown Main Street, it's not a controllable environment, right? You can, politicians can hand out flyers. You can have a protest. You can have a parade. But the mall, which was the new center of suburban congregation, was a private business where you could keep out the ne'er-do-wells.
The public gathering space becomes a private enclosed space.
Yes, yes. And there's a lot of court cases that went along with that in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so there's so much to this, but I think we're digressing from the point of this paper. And it's the idea that Apex, because of its proximity to RTP, has absolutely flourished since 1990.
Yeah, and this is what, like, there's so much, God, Bob, like, you have a job that's to be in a band, and you have to be sound checking soon, and all I want to do is talk about this for, like, 3 hours. But, like, all these things just fascinate me. Like, Apex grows, and you talk about, like, how the key to it was they planned well. And then in the 1990s, before it got too out of control, they put in historic planning, you know, historic zoning, so that you couldn't just tear it down. And then in 2014, North Carolina passes a law that says that, you know, annexation of surrounding territories is by the community's choice. And so now you have a non-contiguous Apex.
Yes.
Which seems in 2014, you basically, like, if the part of your argument is the Apex is such a great place because they're able to manage it and plan it, 2014 is a huge rupture point because no longer is that possible in the same way.
Well, you know, the incorporation is voluntary.
Right.
Apex can't say, you know, they can't just take your land. They can't take your land. Right.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they can take your land, but, you know, because say they need an easement and you're not in corporate Apex, they'll try to buy your land. And then if not, they have the right to eminent domain. But that actually doesn't happen as much as you would think it possibly could.
They're also not going to pass eminent domain to take your house, and then now suddenly you have to pay city taxes and all that. So
So if I might for a moment, Ben, I want to read from my conclusion.
Okay.
Okay. How did the Research Triangle Park reimagine the state of North Carolina's economy and make possible the urban revitalization of historic downtown areas like Apex? Now, let me stop just for a minute. This is an important part. Historic downtowns like Apex. You go to like the historic preservation movement that happened in the, I guess, the late 70s, 80s, and impacted
in the 90s.
In the 90s, there's another thread that needs to be discussed. And Alison Eisenberg, her book, Downtown America, A History of the Place and People Who Made It, she discusses that a lot. And that is a part of that because you go to downtown Apex, and it is like bumping. It is beautiful. Everything's just... It's historic, but it's renovated, and it's this idea of this idealized Disneyland downtown, right? Oh, this is what it was like in the 50s. This isn't what it was like in the 50s. But it's this, like, fantasy land downtown with, like, the craft brewer, with the coffee shop, with the restaurants, the chocolate shop, all the outfitters, you know, the outdoor outfitters. It's this, like, just... Everybody wants to live there. And you drive around the little old downtown area and these houses are being renovated like crazy. And you can't get a house in downtown Apex at this point. I had one store owner said that by his guess, 30% of the people who walk into his store for the first time wind up moving to Apex.
What?
That's what he said. So that is not official data.
Okay. Is he a real estate agent?
No, he's not.
That would make sense.
But he was the town historian for a while.
What?
Yeah. So anyway, how did the Research Triangle Park reimagine the state of North Carolina's economy and make possible the urban revitalization of historic downtown areas like Apex? It did so through one word, planning. Every aspect of the park was planned. It was Romeo Guest's plan in 1954 for using the area's established research institutions to attract industrial research operations to the state. It was Archie Davis's plan to take the park public and establish the Research Park Institute. It was MIT-trained planner Pearson Stewart's plan for a low-density suburban design of the park. Now, let me just stop here. When this park was designed, it was designed to not have residential and commercial businesses. I mean, okay, like restaurants and hotels. But that is changing. That has just changed.
That seems crazy.
So now, and part of the reason why it was designed that way was because they're dealing with chemicals.
With, oh, yeah.
The materials being dealt with. But that is going to change. Like, there will be residences now in RTP. And I don't think I discussed this when we started today. But RTP, it encompasses three counties in North Carolina. It's a 4,000-acre science and technology park. It borders NC State, Duke, UNC Chapel Hill. It impacts seven counties in the state, and it fully encompasses three, Durham, Wake, and Orange. Within those counties, within all the areas that RTP impacts, there's 32 separate municipalities. So that's a big part of the state. Now, getting back to the idea of it all being planned, right? The Research Triangle Foundation in the 70s, I believe, established the Triangle University Center for Advanced Studies and the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, which became incubators for what have we been living for the past 30 years in this country? Technology and biotech. So North Carolina was ahead of the game. So who's there now? GlaxoSmithKline. You know, all of these biotech companies. And so by 1990, the park was full up, right? But it became all these other companies came to the surrounding areas outside of RTP, these Carries and the Apexes and Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill to feed the businesses within the park. So it became this self-fulfilling prophecy that has just exponentially expanded. So now what you have is it's all one metropolitan region. So Ben, you have 32 separate municipalities, but they're all part of one metropolitan region. What does that mean?
As far as politics, as far as policy,
transportation.
You have trouble coordinating probably if you're trying to develop large-scale public transportation.
They have to work together. They have to work together, which they do sometimes. Sometimes they don't.
Is that a race to the bottom type scenario where you see them trying to cut taxes and incentivize people to come there? Or is it just the demand so high that they don't have to worry about that?
The demand's high. I don't have this stat, and this is something, Ben, I need to be reminded when I revisit this. During 2008, the RTP metropolitan region was not impacted like the rest of the country. That's a story to be told. Now, here's another story to be told, and I only have another minute. I got to go. But what about the people outside of this area?
Well, I'm guessing that they are not universally happy about it by the fact that basically Apex is a non-contiguous metropolitan area with interspersed with areas that have people who've chosen not to join.
Yeah. What is happening in Apex is an example of what is happening to municipalities across the region. It's the story of a small town gobbled up by a metropolitan region and the tension that an ever-growing population creates within the existing community and its infrastructure. And then I go on to cite my secondary sources. But I talk about Apex being an example of a planned development, planned high-tech industry, planned infrastructure, and a structured revitalization of a historic downtown area. The question moving forward is whether or not over 30 municipalities can continue working together in the interest of the region as its population grows dense and resources deplete more rapidly. And that's it for now.
It's going to be an interesting question. It is also very fascinating how all of the free market businesses there sure did move to take advantage of those state-subsidized universities using their federally subsidized grants.
So let me close on this. I interviewed Bill Rowe, who wrote a book called The Research Triangle, From Tobacco Road to Global Prominence. And he told me that when RTP was established, what do you think Duke was known for? Duke University. What was this, the aspect of research they were most known for at the time?
Something to do with tobacco?
Paranormal.
What?
The paranormal. So there you have it. That's where Dick Nixon went to law school. And, but that's
saw things nobody else saw, so.
That's right.
Yeah, everybody's after me.
So anyway, more on this in the future. I hope this episode was interesting for somebody.
Yeah, and if you guys, I tell you what, if you got anything to add to this, particularly our patrons, just if you, questions or things to add or recommendations.
Yeah, please.
Why don't you record yourself on your voice recorder and then just email it to us at roadtonowcast@gmail.com, and maybe we can do another episode responding to this, and particularly for the patrons, like, we can happily do one where we dig into it deeper. I've got hours more to say about this.
Yeah, man, you've really helped me to think through this a little bit more and realize how much I don't know about what I've spent this past 6 weeks being obsessed with. So I've got a lot of work to do.
You know, this is the thing. I remember one of my professors in grad school once told me, you are the foremost expert on this thing now.
Well... Yeah, I feel like I have a bunch of miscellaneous facts floating around in my head, so.
Oh, yeah, but we'll put it together, man.
We'll put it together. All right. Well, thanks a lot, everybody. Have a great day.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. As always, also, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout-out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, and the newest one, Susan Sharp. If you'd like to support us and what we do, you can do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/TheRoadToNow. We're working on some pretty cool stuff over there, so I'm excited to share that with y'all. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.